You are about to hear a speech given by Dorothy Day in Melbourne on Sunday afternoon, 16th of August 1970. Her topic was the American Catholic Worker Movement, and the venue was the Public Lecture Theatre at the University of Melbourne. Dorothy spoke for 60 minutes and then took questions and answers for another 50 minutes. The event was chaired by Father John Heffey of St Benedict's, Gladysdale, and the other person who you will hear fixing the microphone and then helping Dorothy to understand the Australian accents of questioners was Professor Max Charlesworth from the Philosophy Department. My name is Val Noon. I recorded Dorothy's speech on the day on a reel-to-reel tape recorder loaned to me by Pat Crudden, then the parish priest of Blackburn North. In 2020, to mark the 50th anniversary of Dorothy's visit to Australia, and to coincide with the publication of my book, which is entitled Dorothy Day in Australia, I have had this digital copy made by Cineclare Productions of Hampton, Victoria. I trust that you will enjoy it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Father John Heffey, and Dorothy Day has been staying with me for a couple of days. Now I've brought her down to talk to you. I want to introduce Dorothy Day.
Father was going to give me a nice long introduction so that I'd have time to gather myself together a little bit. I have such a hard time speaking until I get started that it's always a dread to me. I'm afraid I'm a person who is an activist, and I don't mind getting behind a typewriter, but when it comes down to facing audiences, it's usually very hard. I'd like to tell about the Catholic Worker and about all the different aspects of the work, and to tell the history of it in a way, how it got started. And those of you who have followed the history of the paper probably know a good deal of this already, but at the same time, repetition is always good, to bring out some of the very basic ideas of the work. At the time that I met Peter Morin, the French peasant, who had come over from France and who had worked all over the United States and in Canada, in lumber camps and on the railroads.
I'd like to find father's working properly. Coming up here.
It evidently wasn't turned on. Do you hear it now? No?
You do have to speak directly into it.
This is the way things act around the Catholic Worker. I should feel quite at home. One of the men around the Catholic Worker once said, after a chair fell apart, he said, isn't it time to give this away to the poor? Of course, it might be a little sabotage on the part of somebody or other who doesn't care for our anarchist, pacifist position. But I will try to begin again and talk about the founder of the work, who was a French peasant by the name of Peter Morin. I hope this is working. Yes, it's good. I had been... From the time I was in college, I had been first a socialist and then a member of the communist group and then a member of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. I was a card-carrying member of that. And then afterwards I was more interested in the whole anarchist, the philosophical anarchist point of view. But still, my feelings were very much with the IWW, who believed in the one big union and of organizing all the unorganized and reaching the very poorest. And also they had a slogan that appealed to me very much, although I don't think I really understood its full implications until after I had been a Catholic. And that slogan was, an injury to one is an injury to all. And I felt how close that was to the teaching of St. Paul, who said that when the health of one member of the body suffered, the health of the whole body was lowered. And I had had this background before I became a Catholic at the age of 26 or 7. And then I found that I did some work for the communist group. I worked, as a matter of fact, for the Anti-Imperialist League at the time when the Marines were down in Central America, more or less trying to take over some more of the land down there in order to put through another canal. And I worked with this communist group because that happened to be the job I had when I had become a Catholic. And every time I'd see my dear friend, a Spanish priest who was in the parish church nearby, he'd say, "Well, have you found another job yet?" And I'd say, "No, shall I give this up?" And he'd say, "No, don't give it up until you find another." And so here it was with the Spanish Augustinian priest that I might say I was working with his permission in a communist affiliate. He was a man who very much of the European background, and I think he felt that very much that the communism of a Nicaraguan group was a different kind of communism than the Russian communism, the Marxist-Leninist communism, the communism which was fundamentally atheist in its philosophy. And he was a very understanding person. But he said, "Well, I'll pray that you get another job." And the other job that I got was, first of all, cooking. I went to a parish priest of ours down the country, and I said, "Father, I'd like to work in a camp with my little daughter for the summer." And he said, "No, you come on down and you work as a cook for us. We have a novitiate. It's closed up for the summer. We have just 3 brothers and 3 fathers there. And you come down there and work as a cook." And it was a very delightful summer. As a matter of fact, I used to invite my communist friends, my anarchist friends down. And Father had never seen a communist or an anarchist before. And they had never seen a Catholic priest up close before. So that it brought about a little clarification of thought, I think. But I think also they were both very much afraid of each other. While I was down there, I'm afraid I didn't mind cooking. I liked cooking very much, and they very dutifully ate everything I put in front of them. But I wasn't a good housekeeper, and I used to sit in the kitchen and write a play. So the play that I wrote, I sent out to Hollywood. And one day, it was on the Feast of the Assumption. Father will be interested in that. We've just celebrated the Feast of the Assumption out at St. Benedict's Farm. On the Feast of the Assumption, I got a telephone call from Hollywood saying to come on out and write dialogue, to show up in their offices in New York and sign a short-term contract, and come on out within the next week or so and write dialogue. So I insisted on finishing my term with the fathers, with the Marist fathers, which was only a few weeks longer. They were only closed for July and August. So then I went out to Hollywood, and I proceeded to write dialogue, which was one of the most miserable periods of my life. I was so lonely for New York, and so lonely for my former comrades, all of them. And to be in this atmosphere, I used to feel, well, the best thing I could do would be to save every penny I earned and take a little jaunt to Mexico on the way home and get back to New York as quick as possible. And just at that moment, the Depression struck. So I went down to Mexico, lived in Indian villages, and saw something of what a persecution means, how the churches were closed or just reopened, but how all the schools were closed and how there was a terrific conflict between church and state going on. At the same time, I had communist friends down there. These friends were very much alive. Two of them were from California. They were working for land for the landless. They were working for another kind of a social order. They were working, as a matter of fact, very much for the kind of thing that they're having now in Mexico, the ejidos, a form of community ownership of land. And one of these friends, Tina Madoti, her name was, one day I went to see her, and here was her door all taped up. She was arrested by the state and put in prison. And anytime anybody voiced anything in regard to any kind of change in the social order, that was the kind of persecution that was taking place, which, of course, kept my sympathies very much with those who were working for social justice. I wrote articles while I was there and sent them to the Commonweal. Most of the articles that I wrote, serious articles about revolution and about the social order, about what I was learning about this new system of land ownership, the ejidos, most of these serious articles were all turned down. I had learned before in newspaper work, I come from a newspaper family, that women should always write personally. They should always write about something like taking your child to a feast day celebration out in Xochimilco. And so when I wrote a few articles like that, they were all taken. And I wrote a series of articles. And everything that I wrote at that time, that I wrote personally about my travels with my child, was accepted. When I came back to New York, I continued to try to write some serious articles for the Commonweal, but they'd always say, oh, write another article about Tamara Teresa and travels in Mexico or around the United States or whatever you want. So one day, Peter Morin showed up at the Commonweal office and began telling about his ideas, which were very much the same as mine, about the need of the worker for land and for bread and for work. And so, to get rid of him, and also because they recognized the fact that he had very much the same kind of ideas that I was trying to explore, they sent him down to me. And so he was the one who laid down a program of action. He came in from the street, he came in from the Bowery, he was a man who lived the life of a St. Francis. He had been trained by the Christian Brothers in France. He had worked in Paris with a group called Les Sillons. It was a group headed by a man by the name of Marc Saunier. And it was a group very much liked doing very much the same kind of work that we're doing. Running across a volume of Pope John the 23rd's letters when he was in Paris, I came across a letter he wrote to the widow of Marc Saunier, in which he talked about how great an influence this man had on his thinking as a young man. And it made me very happy to see this letter, because this was the movement in France that more or less influenced Peter Morin's thinking. He came from a peasant family. His own mother died when she'd had four or five children. His father married again, and altogether there were 22 children in the family. They were peasants. There was a certain amount of land held in common. There was a common shepherd to take all the sheep out to the pastures and the mountains. And they lived a very simple life. There was a common bakery, a common bake oven where people went to bake their bread. There was this whole attitude, you see, of a community working together and sharing together. Peter was influenced not only by this movement that I spoke of, but he was also influenced very much by the anarchists. There was one anarchist, Peter Kropotkin, who had lived in Paris in his exile, and he had written books called Fields, Factories, and Workshops, and another one called The Conquest of Bread, and still another one, Mutual Aid. And all of these ideas were that the state was the enemy, that the state took upon itself all, everything, even to the ownership of the indigent, and that the better thing to emphasize was what the popes have called the principle of subsidiarity, and that is that the state should never take on itself those things which smaller bodies could do. So that interpreting this in the light of our particular needs here, it would be that the unions would go ahead and try to deal with the problems of housing. And I had known two of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers and International Ladies Garment Workers who took all their surplus funds and put them into cooperative housing. And these houses, these housing units, very humanly built with gardens and with trees in the center, are down on the Deep East Side and up in the Bronx. And these units and these particular housing settlements have continued to this day over a period of, well, I'm sure, 40 years. They also had their own clinics. They had credit unions. And so a union, you see, was taking upon itself these things which now the state is arrogating to itself. And this was the function, you see, that these smaller bodies of men, of course, many of them are way too large, but these smaller bodies of men, the various locals, would take on different aspects of work that was needed. I know they have not only the clinics in New York and these housing cooperatives, but they also have places in the country where they run summer courses, where they have lectures, where they have concerts. And these are settlements up in the Poconos, up in the hills in Pennsylvania. So that when you've already experienced this principle of subsidiarity and how it works out, you see how the state is encroaching. That's what the bishop said in one of their messages, the all-encroaching state and the danger of it. And we've lived through a time of totalitarian states, the Stalin, the Hitler, the Mussolini, and the dictators in various other countries. And so we know that this is the tendency of the day, that everything must be taken over by the state, everything must be done because the problem is too large, everything is too big. Well, Peter's answer to all this was so simple, so very simple, that it was disregarded for a long time. He was a man who went around, he worked in a camp up the Hudson, and he went around and tried to interest people in these ideas. He went to magazines like America and the Commonweal. He went to various priests. He went to the Social Action Department down in Washington. He went to these people to present a program of action. He was always considered a very simple man, but they gradually began to see how profound a thinker he was. And he said that a basic need was voluntary poverty, and that when he came to me and suggested we start a paper, and I said, well, where is the money to do these things? He said, well, in the Catholic Church, you don't need any money to do anything. You just start. So It proved perfectly true, of course. We got a paper underway. The first issue was taken out on the streets. I said, how we build up circulation? And he said, if you wish to reach the man in the street, you go to the man in the street. So our friends took the paper out, and took it out in Union Square and at demonstrations and sold it on street corners. And they're doing this kind of thing to this day. One of our editors, our former editors, who's now dead, was one of the greatest street salesmen we ever had. He believed in a very personal and direct contact with people. His name was Ammon Hennessy, and he called himself the one-man revolution. And he took the papers out on the streets, and he had a regular routine. One day would be in front of Wall Street offices, and another day would be in front of Cooper Union Lecture Hall, another day between up at Columbia University, another day at Fordham University, sometimes in front of Grand Central Station. These ways, he came in contact with people, not only in the city, not only with students, but also with people from all over the United States. So when I'd be traveling and talking, everybody I'd meet would say, oh yes, I met the Catholic worker first at the corner of the 43rd Street in Lexington Avenue. And I met Ammon Hennessy, and he explained to me the principles. So he had these direct confrontations with people all over the city and all over the country. This went on for the 5 years that he spent with us before he went west to start a house of hospitality out there. The second thing that Peter said was, in addition to voluntary poverty, was to, voluntary poverty meant that each one gave whatever he had, and that whatever was lacking, the Lord would take care of. But the second principle of reaching the man in the streets, the man everywhere, was not just going out to the street, but the performance of the works of mercy. I know that when we first tried to get a list of the works of mercy, none of the prayer books we had around the place listed them, none of the missals. Everybody was getting very liturgical at the time, and also they were going in for the welfare state, and so the works of mercy were very much out of style. They still are rather out of style, but I've seen some wonderful examples here in Australia of works of mercy that I'll go back home and talk about. For instance, the works of mercy, we keep pointing out, are the opposite of the works of war. Eileen Egan here once gave us a talk at the Catholic Worker, and that was the thing she brought out. And we repeated again and again and again. One of the young men who was a conscientious objector and went to jail a few years ago, finished his term now and is living up in the country in New York. He not only wrote an article about the works of mercy and the works of war, but one of the girls who was an illustrator, a mother of six children on our farm at Tivoli, she did the illustration of the works of mercy. And the works of mercy, as we all know from the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, are, well, how we will be judged. And they are feeding the hungry and clothing the naked, giving drinks to the thirsty, housing the homeless, visiting the sick, visiting the prisoner, burying the dead. And the war, every war we see prosecuted is just exactly the opposite, and that is destroying the homes, destroying food supplies by embargo or by poisoning or by spraying. Everything is the opposite. Instead of visiting the sick, you're filling the hospitals with people. A friend of mine who's lost two sons back in Philadelphia in the Vietnam War is spending all her time now visiting the hospitals. And she says the mental hospitals are filling up, all the veterans' hospitals are filling up, and there will be a need for the rest of our lives of visiting the hospital, visiting the sick, made this way by the wars we've been prosecuting. The works of mercy, you see, are direct action. They're not waiting for some agency to take over. They're not waiting until they've been processed and they have been questioned. They are the immediate practice of the works of mercy, direct action. And these are to be performed in houses of hospitality around the country. And the first house of hospitality we had was really the office of the Catholic Worker. I don't know whether, I always say we've been pushed into everything we do. If I hadn't had someone like Peter Morin, who always impressed everybody as being so close to God, so much another St. Francis, another St. Benedict, another St. Vincent de Paul. He reminded you of the saints, and he reminded you also of the techniques of the saints. And he talked about the houses of hospitality. Well, he also talked about if your brother is hungry, feed him. So people came in with their troubles, and if it was time for supper and the staff was about to sit down, well, whoever came in was invited too. That grew into a breadline during the Depression that was 1,000 long. But at the beginning, there was just the handful of us. The handful consisted of one man who had been sleeping in Central Park, arrested every morning, held in jail for the day, then put out again to go back and sleep in Central Park. He was a college graduate. And this was during the Depression. And the second man we had coming to us was a man who was living in a packing box down by the East River. And the third man was a man who was a middle-aged fellow who had been a real estate man, a man of some substance, and he was living in a basement sleeping next to a furnace. And these were the three men that made up the beginnings of our staff. And then young college students came, and we would sit together, take turns eating together. Our first cook was a girl who was a textile worker from Pennsylvania. She'd worked in these textile mills and come to the city to look for work, and said that in the rooming house where she was staying, a man climbed in over the fire escape and raped her. She was afraid to cry out for fear that she would be put out of the house as a disreputable woman. And she became pregnant and wandered the streets, she said, before she came down to us. She said she walked around the block 6 times before she came in. And she came in, and she had our baby with us, and she became our cook. She was a Lithuanian girl. And she used to go over to the market, and she'd pick up the lettuce leaves and the outside stalks of celery and things like that from the market, from the trash bins of the market. And she would make us the most delicious dishes with all the things that she'd gathered together. One of her best dishes, of course, was mashed potatoes with creamed mushrooms on top. We sat down to many a lovely meal that this girl prepared for us. Her little daughter was named Barbara, and she was so much a part of the family. I remember when the first bishop came to see us and gave us all his blessing. She said, when he gave me his blessing, it felt just like a blood transfusion. She'd been to the hospital, and she'd been ill, and so she knew what a blood transfusion felt like. Then also, in addition to her cooking, why, we took turns cooking, too. And one man came in one time, and we wanted to know how we could help him, and he said, I would just like to soak my feet. So we got dish pans or whatever pans were big enough for his very large feet, and he sat down. He soaked his feet for the afternoon. Of course, he stayed for supper. We asked him where he was sleeping, and he said, down by the river. He said, there's a good place on a wharf down there. It was summertime. So he came every day to us after that and began selling the paper on the street. Big Dan Orr, his name was. And he also became very much one of those who spread the paper spread it over the country because people would buy it, listen to Big Dan Orr. I remember one time he was shouting the paper on 14th Street, and when he saw me coming, he said, "Read the Catholic Worker, romance on every page." There was another girl who sold the paper on the street, too. And she said, some fella came up and told her, didn't like the picture that Ottie Bethune had drawn of Mary Magdalene. And she said, "Well, why don't you like it?" She was very belligerent. He said, "Well, it doesn't look like Greta Garbo." That was his comment, all these kind of things. And so he stayed to tease her, and he said, "I know you're a cardinal. He gets drunk every Saturday night with his housekeeper." And she said, "Doesn't that just show how democratic he is?" So these were the kind of beginnings we had. One time, a girl came in the afternoon, and she said she'd been sleeping out in subways, and the companion, the girl that was traveling around with her, had become so desperate and so ill that she'd flung herself under a subway train. And she said, "I read your paper. I picked it up in the park, and it's..." The paper that she'd read was a message to the bishops, and it was about the need for houses of hospitality, the need for hospices where people could be sheltered and could be fed and could be taken care of. And she said, where are these houses? And we didn't know of any. So she said, "Well, why do you write about them then when you don't know of any? Why don't you start something?" So putting us on the spot in this way, after this terribly tragic story, we called up the parish priest, and he called up some of the women of the parish. We went down the street, and we rented an apartment. We managed to borrow and scrape together enough money to pay the 2 months' rent necessary, 1 month for security, they call it. And the friends in the neighborhood contributed a few beds, and the women gathered together sheets and blankets. And that was how the first house of hospitality started. It took one afternoon to do it. It was truly direct action. We didn't bother to clean the place or anything else. We all cleaned it as we were moving into it. And that was the first woman's house of hospitality. And then one of our readers came and offered us a house. And it was down in a slum on Mott Street, a big Italian tenement. It was 20 rooms, and it was 4 rooms on a floor. Mother Cabrini used to visit there when she was making one of her foundations in New York. And they were dark rooms. They were back in behind 5-story tenements in front. There were 2 rooms on either side of a hallway. They had little fireplaces in them. There was 1 toilet in the hall on each floor and 1 sink in each apartment. There was no hot water, no heat. And that was the first big house of hospitality we had. The first people we took care of was a bunch of seamen who came to us the very day we were moving in. And they were on strike down the waterfront. And they wanted to know if we could put up some of them. So they were the ones who helped us clean and paint and whitewash the place, and they were the ones who helped distribute the paper in the waterfront and among the union men down there that were forming at that time into the National Maritime Union. We had many a discussion about we started a headquarters on the west side to feed the seamen while they were on strike, thanks to these men. And one of the men from the Bowery, which was nearby, said, "Why are you worrying about these men? They're working for a union. They're going to build up a union. They're working, and here on the Bowery are these unemployables. These are the men with ruptures and with epilepsy and injuries of various kinds. And who is caring for them? Who is taking care of them?" We never started to take care of Bowery derelicts, as they're called. We never intended to do anything like this, but you see, there again, we had this push. This man, his name was John Griffin. when men would come in to see if we had any clothes, shoes or socks or coats or sweaters, he'd say, "Well, there's nothing left, but you can put a piece of paper in the front of your coat. That'll keep out some of the cold, and you can just sit down and have another cup of coffee." And so that was how the coffee line started, and the bread line. Without our doing a thing about it, one man began putting a big pot of coffee on the stove, and that grew to 1,000 men or over. We have pictures of them. In one of the books I've written, they have pictures of this line extending down and around the block. It grew, of course, to right now we have a soup line in New York. It's a soup line now with split peas and beans and lentils and every kind of... One man goes around and collects bones from butcher shops. Everybody, these are people in the neighborhood, people who come to make their contribution, who come to say, you know, this is our work. And so they enter into it. So that houses of hospitality started that way, by themselves and just because we were pushed into it. Certainly, most of us liked the idea of sitting down writing about these things. And yet here was the opportunity, here was the direct action, and here was also the tradition of the IWW, who usually had some old lodging house and a pot of soup on the stove, and anyone coming by could make himself at home there. The other houses around the country started very much the same way. They read the paper. I remember in Detroit, groups of people would come together and say, "Well, why don't we start a house of hospitality?" And a big gang would come, maybe 200 or 300 people. Well, naturally, with 200 or 300 people, you can't do anything. And then after they'd had 3 or 4 or 5 meetings, nothing happened. Two men were walking down the street, and one of them was a fireman, and the other one was working on one of the Great Lakes steamers. And they said, "Here, we've got our pay in our pocket, and here's an empty house. Let's go in and rent it and start a house of hospitality." And so that's exactly the way that house started. Two men with their pay in their pocket, paying for it themselves and using everything they had themselves. And then, of course, whatever else is needed comes in. Actually, the house that they rented, they had to keep moving from house to house, because to have a whole bunch of disreputable people moving into a neighborhood usually aroused the wrath of the neighbors, all good Christian neighbors, all good Catholics, and of every nationality. And finally, we found hospitality in a very good Italian neighborhood. And when the woman died, she left her house to the Pope, the house that we rented from her. The house was left to the Pope, and so then the Pope was our landlord for a short period. What happened, of course, is that the diocese took care of the situation and turned the house over to us for a very small rental. So that these houses built up just this way, a small way all over the United States, and they turn into places where they are all of them have a soup line, all of them have places where people can come and stay overnight. You can't possibly put up all the people that are that come. In New York, we have a 5-story house. We have 3 floors that are rooms and dormitories. And we've had to rent 3 other apartments across the street. And some Loreto nuns have come to spend the summer with us. And they have the 1st-floor apartment across the street, and they pay for the rent of that apartment by doing the janitor's work in the house. They sweep down the halls and the stairs, clean the backyard, and put out the garbage cans, and are doing this manual labor in order to pay their rent. And meanwhile, come over and help us cook and clean and take care of the sick and the other work of the House of Hospitality. So students, sisters, seminarians, they're the ones who are working in our houses. The third part of Peter Morin's program was the return to the land. Now, this is the most unpopular part. Everybody gravitates to the city very often because they're gregarious, but also they gravitate to the cities because there's work and there's medical care. You're more or less abandoned when you're in the country. And Peter Morin wanted things like farming communes, he said. Sometimes he called them agronomic universities. He was very much interested in the kibbutzim of Israel, and he felt that this was a model also that we could follow. The kibbutzim or the moshavim, these ways of holding land, these ways of cooperating. And he felt that these were solutions to the problems of unemployment. For a long time, we had a heading in the paper, the two center pages, "There is no unemployment on the land." And everybody would come in and argue with us about this, "No unemployment on the land." But what he meant was that no matter how old you were, you could help take care of the chickens. No matter how old you were or how disabled you were, there was always some kind of work you could do. And no matter how young you were, there was also work in which you could participate. And there could be mutual aid. There could be a working together, a building up of a library, a building up of a school of a sort, a building up of cooperative effort. So that we did start farms. When I tell of our first effort at having a farm, Father Heffy here visited us on the first farm we had down in eastern Pennsylvania. I don't know whether he knows how we got our first cow. A convert out in Kansas by the name of Rosenberg sent us money, $60, and said, "Go buy yourself a cow." Well, you could get a cow for $60 then. So the young men on the farm, most of them students and city fellows, one of them a taxi driver, they didn't know how to buy a cow. They went to a neighboring farmer, and he said, "Well, there's a field full of cows. Go on out and pick one out." So they looked a little bit frightened of all these cows, but they managed to get together a few of the cows that looked as though they were giving milk, and they sat down in various parts and tried milking some of them. And the one that was easiest to milk, they bought. She turned out, however, to be a very nice cow. She gave many a calf, and she gave a good deal of milk. And she let anybody go ahead and learn to milk on her. So we had cows, and we had goats, and we had a few sheep, and we had chickens. A young man going to the seminary gave us his last money. We bought 6 pigs with that. We used to say the rosary out around the statue of the Blessed Mother. And no sooner did we get started saying the rosary than all those pigs would escape from their pen and start running all over the whole place. And always 2 or 3 people who maybe wanted to get out of saying the rosary would dash after the pigs. It was a great distraction, a great distraction. But it was the first year, the first couple of years at that farm were certainly very happy. Everybody began bringing their disabled and their sick, their invalids. One woman brought us about 10 children, some of them Negroes from Harlem, and some of them longshoremen's children down by the river. And fortunately, she always brought money, too, enough to buy the various things we needed to keep going. And other people brought their invalids. One of the things that always irked me was, though, that with everybody bringing us people to take care of, other people would come and say, "Are you self-sustaining?" And we would say, "With a family like this, how can you be self-sustaining? There has to be more cooperation." But the farm was a very happy place. One of the sociologists at the Catholic University wrote an article about it and said, "They have talked a great deal about family farms and families going to the land, but so far all they've accomplished is a home for celibate seamen." Well, This was after 1 year, and it was true that we had three seamen there. One of them turned out to be a cook, and one turned out to be a good farmer. And these men, the other one almost set fire to the place, so they weren't all assets. But we had certainly all a group of young people, and I would say that many of them became very impatient at not achieving more success in our farming. Many of them had many ideas. They wanted to start a little theater. They wanted this. They wanted that. And a lot of the work, everybody chose his own work that he wanted to do. But actually, after, as the time passed, and there were a few marriages, and children began to come, well, then people began to fall into a sense of the infinite patience that's needed to go ahead and do any work. All of these things are so small, you see, and all of them are within the possibility of everyone to try to do, so that the very smallness of it means that people all around the country began to say, well, why can't we do this? Why can't we get a house or a house of hospitality? Why can't we get a little piece of land where people can go and work and live together? So that around the country, there are a number of houses, maybe 15 houses, and you lose track. I know that there, I can think of about 5 farms now. Right now, I can't think of any others, but they're always springing up. They're always springing up and making beginnings and sometimes working out into a group of families, sharing the land and working together. They're not exactly farming communes, not exactly agronomic universities, as Peter talked about. He lived until 1949, but a basic point of his teaching was that nothing is achieved by the use of force. That one of God's greatest gifts to man is his freedom. And that he chose, that he didn't try to compel anybody. That he set the example of washing the feet of others. That he said that as I have done, you do likewise. And he went ahead and said, he who wishes to be a leader must be a servant. So these were the things, these basic things. And always in the very beginning, the issue came up over and over again with the young men, the issue of war. First of all, reconstruction within this framework, within the shell of the old, build anew. And then on the other hand, this opposition to war. So that the young men all through the work began going out on demonstrations. In the very beginning, we demonstrated against the Japanese-Chinese war. Back in the early 30s, we demonstrated against their shipping scrap iron to Japan. We got the cooperation of the longshoremen on the West Coast. We got the cooperation of St. Mary's football team out there at a big college. So that you had workers and scholars coming together on an issue, which meant that if we are trying to believe and trying to work out the brotherhood of man, that all men are brothers, that this issue of war had to be taken up on all fronts. The next war was the Ethiopian War, and very much endorsed by a great many of the clergy. I know one of our dear Franciscan friends in Italy, Father Gemelli, he went ahead and was a very ardent supporter of Mussolini. Mussolini was upheld as someone who fought communism. The whole idea of a dictatorship just didn't seem to occur. The limitation of man's freedom, this was no issue. People began thinking only in terms of fighting communism. And so liberty went by the board. We were already losing what we were supposed to be fighting for. Peter Morin gave us great intellectual food. And in addition to the French teachers like Mounier, Emmanuel Mounier, who was the editor of Esprit, he brought us Dom Luigi Sturzo, the Italian, who wrote a book called Italy and the Fascismo. and who wrote books on the church and the state, and was one of the great thinkers of Italy, and a man very much under a cloud and discredited because of his opposition to Mussolini. As the time passed, however, there was the Ethiopian War, that was over. After that, the Spanish Civil War. Again, we had to point out that church could not be defended by the use of arms. There was no way to defend religion or to go ahead and stabilize society or to try to rebuild it. So that we were then in very hot water. We had built up a circulation from 3,000 to about 140,000. And many were those were bundles going out to the various parishes. And because of our stand in the Spanish Civil War, our circulation dropped to 40,000. We lost 100,000 in that particular war because people began to see that we really meant what we were talking about, that our Lord spoke in terms of loving the enemy, of turning the other cheek, keeping coals of fire on his head, and always, always thinking in terms of man's freedom. I remember in the Second World War, people said, Jesus Christ lived for all his life in an occupied country and never tried to liberate it. It was not the point he was making. He was thinking in terms of man's freedom wherever he was and man's need to know and to love his brother. It's the only way he had of showing his love for God. The Spanish Civil War, then the Second World War. After that, we had the Korean War, other wars around the world. And now, of course, here we are immersed in the Vietnam War. And there is a front which is occupying all the young men of our work. Many of them have been to jail already for not answering to the draft. Many of them have not answered the call for induction. It's gotten to the point where there's so many going to jail and so many in opposition that in the state of California, half of those who are called up don't answer. Half of them. They can't possibly keep up with them. And this revolt, this bringing by demonstration and by marches to Washington, by the speaking out of the laymen and clergy concerned, the getting together of all the different peace groups, has meant, so far, very little change. The thing people fear is, of course, the dropping of the bomb. But this work for peace is very much a part of this whole program that Peter Morin initiated. The thing also that I must end with is that the nonviolent movement in the United States is by no means dead. Many of the peace groups may seem to become very militant, but at the same time, there is a down at the bottom again, among the blacks, among the Filipinos, among the Mexicans, there's a tremendously strong movement that's building up another social order within the shell of the old and standing resolutely against war. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, everybody said the peace movement or the nonviolent movement is dead amongst the blacks. And they were always pointing to the Black Panthers and the Northern blacks as an example. And yet we have tremendous followers of Martin Luther King. Ralph Abernathy, who recently was in South America, issuing a manifesto with Dom Helder Camara about the situation of poverty in the world. There's Jesse Jackson in Chicago, the Northern black who has what he calls Operation Breadbasket and who gets together with the black people on the South Side every single Saturday morning. They have a meeting which was about 5,000 people gathering together. And they sing hymns, they pray together, They discuss the problems. He's a man who is really a tremendous leader. And there's Andrew Young, who is a graduate from Harvard Theological School. He also is another leader of the blacks. And the recent move in the South has been the organization of the Negro population, who have never been organized before, into hospital workers' unions, garbage collectors, and so on. And in 15 cities, they're organized. This is a union which is neither CIO nor AFL. It's the Distributive Workers' Union, and I suppose it numbers about 85,000. And this is the movement among the blacks and the Afro-Americans, most of our communist friends call them. It's a better term, I think, than the blacks. I always feel as though they are forcing this down our throats. We are the blacks. But there's this other movement on the West Coast of the Mexicans and the Filipinos, and that is a tremendous movement. They have won the first part of a long strike, this grape strike, which lasted for the last 5 years. And these men have gone out to cities all over the United States and carried on a very intensive boycott. And through the boycott, through the weapon, a nonviolent weapon, they have been successful in getting contracts with 65% of the grape growers of California. Now they're aiming at orange, citrus fruits, cantaloupe, all kinds of vegetables, and a better condition for the farm worker throughout the country. The whole position of the farm worker has been a terrible one. They live in the same kind of conditions that your Aborigines live in, same kind of shacks, the same kind of destitution. And they have no land. All land has been lost that they have tried to. Cesar Chavez, the leader of the movement, his father had had land in Arizona. He's a Mexican-American. But he has proven a leader of such integrity that he has been hailed by all the other unions. He's revitalized them. He's brought back to them some of their early idealism. Here is a group of the poorest in the country, the Mexicans and Filipinos, who have banded together and with common soup kitchens and with the mutual aid that comes from such a work as this, have lived for these 5 years in this strike and have achieved this measure of victory. So these things are great movements of nonviolence in the United States today. And there's a very interesting book, a very powerful book written about Cesar Chavez, which is more or less a lesson to all of us on the kind of action that can be taken. He's a man of great strength, and he's a strong Catholic. A chaplain has been appointed to the Union. When he marched on the capital of California, Sacramento, he called it a penitential procession. He engaged in a fast of 25 days because there had been some violence breaking out in the Union, and this fast was one of penance, too. Now, these things mark him as a man who is a man who has a vision of man as a creature of body and soul. He thinks much further than the Union ideal. He thinks in terms of kinds of land ownership, such as they're trying to work out in Tanzania in Africa, where they are experimenting with these collective and cooperative farms, a movement inspired again by Israel rather than by Russia. They're smaller countries, and so there can be this kind of experimentation. But he's thinking in terms of different forms of ownership, different kinds of cooperation. They've already set up communal farms, communal camps, for those who are the old and the sick. And they have their own gardens and are making a self-supporting thing of their first Filipino labor camp. They have a clinic. They have a cooperative, a credit union. They have 40 acres, which is the beginning of some land ownership for the union and for the membership of the union. But these are the kind of things that the Catholic Worker takes up and writes about. And we are, in general, people who are powerless, the students who are quite incapable of through political action or any other kind of action, achieving any of these things. But in this, you might say, this little way, this way of the one-man revolution, of personal responsibility, of voluntary poverty, and of dedication to another kind of a social order, there has been a tremendous response, it seems to me, not only in the United States, but in a great many other countries, too. Thank you.
Dorothy will be very pleased to answer any questions. Ask, anybody would like to ask some questions? For the moment, we'll give her a little rest to suck a jupe. And His Grace the Archbishop has sent an apology. And he was unable to attend today. And also... Bob Santa Maria said an apology. Dorothy said that I had not given her a chance at the beginning. I'd been too brief. But I found that it's a little dangerous. I told Dorothy that when I was in Mott Street, New York in 1940, I remembered her, she was a young, pretty active then, and she's still pretty active as a matter of fact. She used to roll her own cigarettes. And she said yes. She said, she must have met a good priest later who gave her a remedy to stop smoking. Now, I'm dying for a smoke myself, as a matter of fact, at the moment, but I'll give you all this very good remedy. After your morning prayers and after your night prayers, you say, "Dear God, let me want to give up smoking." Now then you just go on smoking. You don't bother anymore. But you also go on saying that every day. And Dorothy seems to imply that in the end, God wins. So after that, I hesitated. I don't know what quite to do myself. I hesitated about asking any more questions. As she said, they're all personal answers, or rather they make you want to provide a personal answer. Peter Moran was also there, and when we were there in 1940, and we remember Peter, although he was, his books are widely read, Peter didn't keep books that weren't good books. And he used to read a book and he'd tear the page off and put it in the basket on a railway station and he'd read the next page. And if, however, it was a good book, having read it, he'd give it to somebody else to read. There was a young priest with us when we visited Dorothy in 1940, and we stood in the bread line ourselves and helped a little, and asked a lot of questions, like I'm going to let you very soon ask. And we were from the seminary with the theology dripping from our minds into a void, unfortunately, too often. Our minds, I mean. And one of us asked Dorothy, well, what is it now, the spiritual background, the doctrine on which this is all based? Is it the doctrine of the mystical body? And Dorothy simply said, well, look, a man is hungry and we give him something to eat. So I mentioned that to Dorothy during this visit, and she said, well, I was probably just bringing him down to earth. So that's what I've found anyway. All the questions I've asked Dorothy, she's brought me down to earth. Now, would anybody like to ask some questions?
I don't think I was being fresh. I think I was just afraid to start talking theology to five seminarians. One was ordained already. And also, I didn't want to go into the long discussion of anarchism, pacifism, or even go into the 25th chapter of St. Matthew. I mean, it is obvious. One of the meanest things that we've had to encounter is people who do come, though, and say, you don't mean to tell me that these people can't get work if they wanted to. And that is usually the response to a long line of men waiting for something to eat, as though that were an easy way to get your daily bread. There's no easy way at all. Yes? Mm-hmm. Well, as for people taking advantage, it does seem to me that all of us who have had more in this world and who had the benefits of education and a family and the capacity to enjoy books and music and so on and so forth have a great debt to pay to people who have done the hard labor of the world. The anarchist philosophy is that a man who cleans the sewers ought to get the same pay as a man who managed an industry or a collective farm. I mean, this question of every man is entitled to food, clothing, and shelter. The Lord has put on this earth enough for everyone. And when it comes down to people taking advantage, I would say that we take advantage of God every day of our lives. We receive constantly. How worthy are we? And what have we done to deserve the better health and the better conditions which we have ourselves? It does seem to me that we just have a great need to try to express this sense that we are brothers. You don't see your brother in need and turn away from him. So, I mean, it doesn't matter about taking advantage. Actually, the Catholic Worker all around the country could be run by all these people that have come in to get help. But you don't measure their response or measure what they do. We have all kinds of things happening. One man walked off with one of our few typewriters and took it over to the Bowery to sell it for liquor. And a policeman caught him walking down the street with a typewriter, and he said, "Where'd you come from?" He said, "Oh, I brought this from the Catholic Worker. They hold everything in common there." So he took the man on the typewriter back to us. Of course, we didn't intend to prosecute him or anything. But another occasion, a man came in late in the evening, and the fellow who was sort of being night watchman around the place said, "You just sit down here and rest yourself, have a cup of coffee from the stove, and I'm going on over to the Bowery and see if I can find a place open where I can get some chewing tobacco." So he walked out of the place and left this man. When he came back, the man was gone, and there was a big turkey that somebody had brought in and put in the refrigerator for us for the next day. It was Thanksgiving, and the man had taken the turkey with him. Well, everybody was absolutely indignant, you know. What a dirty, filthy trick that was. They all got so angry. And one of the lives of the saints was of a man who was held up and robbed. And he ran after the robbers to tell them they hadn't gotten everything. There was still a gold piece tied up in the corner of his cloak. And he wanted to give them that too. So it's the whole idea, you see, this idiotic idea that if anybody takes your coat, give them your cloak too. So I told everybody they should run after him with the cranberries and the celery. But that isn't the point of the story. Although the lives of the saints have many points to teach us. The point of the story was that 10 years afterward, the same man came in, and sort of taking it as a joke, but also quite serious, he said, he said, "Oh, I've always remembered that was a dirty trick I played, walking off with that turkey. But," he says, "here, I want to pay for it." And he put down $15. And this actually happened. These things seem unbelievable, but they do happen. So here was a man who had taken advantage of us. Well, I think these are all little lessons that we get that the Lord sends us.
How far does the religious movement for guaranteeing food and shelter, working along with the secular movement, such as the guaranteeing of income movement, stay involved by the people? It's adopted as a policy by some politicians, and not by many, and some psychologists and psychiatrists.
Well, we're guaranteeing voluntary poverty. We're not guaranteeing incomes. As a matter of fact,
just to have food and shelter for everybody as a right, a secular right, not a welfare warfare state arrangement, but a pure human right.
I didn't get the part about the rest
it's not
of
welfare in the sense that it's a welfare warfare arrangement whereby if you work, you get the welfare things, and if you also work and have welfare, you must fight. This normal arrangement. It's something beyond that. It was that there's a secular right of man to have food and clothing. It's been accepted by this sort of Theobald, who proposed this, and many other people supporting this idea.
Yes, but they don't get it. They may have a right to it, but they're not actually getting it. Otherwise, there wouldn't be the need for our type of places. But they have other psychological needs, I think you were pointing out. That was the part of your question I didn't get.
Well, there are two movements, obviously. One which takes its inspiration from religion, which says every man has a right, takes it from Matthew and so on. And this other one which works upon a sociological and psychological base of the improvement to a country that would take place anywhere if everybody could have food and shelter as a right without having to be working for it or do anything for it at all except to be alive. And this secular movement has been going on underway in America. I think Goldwater supported it among other people, strangely enough.
Who?
I wonder if you'd heard much of it. Even Senator Goldwater, I think, supported this among other people.
Barry Goldwater.
Oh.
I think he supported it.
But the whole point is that we are opposed to the state going ahead and doing these things and more or less owning people, body and soul. And also the other point is that by such communal efforts through people living together in common, and there is certainly many other needs are supplied. There are many other things besides food, clothing, and shelter. A place like ours on the Hudson, we have about 85 acres and three big buildings. And we have all kinds of people that move in with us, and they're squatters, and few of them are hermits. And in the long run, they all make their contribution. And it'd be hard to list all the different things, but they all work out. It does seem to me that the secular and the religious point of view should go together very closely. We're made up of body and soul. We're integrated people. You can't separate the two. If you go ahead, just coming here, we stopped in Honolulu for the night, and here on the streets of Honolulu, we saw these monks, these Buddhist monks in their yellow robes and their little bells and these prayer groups that were going around. And I'd just been seeing them on the Bowery in New York and on 2nd Avenue. The search for religion, the search for the spiritual life, all of those things are part of a movement. There's no, we're Catholics, but amongst us there are many who are not. There are Jews, there are young Buddhists, there are people who are there because they want to study, write, paint, and combine it with the Benedictine ideal of manual labor and working for the common good. These things are taken care of more or less by the social pressures that are in any kind of a society, any kind of a grouping. Seems to me we do leave people alone. We believe people should respect each other and respect each other's privacy. But these things work out. Actually, a very simple solution to some of our social problems was suggested by Mr. Sheed once. He was talking about our use of the boycott should extend to boycotting people. And when you think of communion breakfasts where industrialists sit down with bishops and known exploiters of labor, just because they're wealthy, go ahead and have the honor and esteem of others because they're rich. I was reading something about the vested interests here in the West. I came across a pamphlet the other day. And here are men who are knighted for their ability to acquire great wealth because they have a genius at expanding their industrial empires. All these things could be handled also by a very strong boycott on the part of people. People don't like to be branded in this way. And it seems to me that if we had no respect for the money that they have acquired, no respect for their ability to make money, that those in themselves, that kind of action in itself has the nonviolent action of beginning to work on people. I probably haven't answered your question at all, but for one thing, it's rather hard for me to understand Australian.
Would you accept it if it was given to everybody in the United States? Would you accept this guaranteed annual income?
All these things that come from the hands of the state enslave you. St. Hilary said, the less you have of Caesar's, the less you have to render to Caesar. And Samuel Johnson said a long time ago, the pensioner of the state is the slave of the state. You're not a free man when it's a government going ahead and guaranteeing you anything. We We don't pay income tax because we don't get salaries, but now they're beginning to work on us to file returns, whatever that may mean. And they're threatening me with jail, and I would just as soon go there, I tell them. If I need to, it's one way of making a protest against war. To go ahead and not pay income tax, to go ahead as many have done in the peace movement. There's a widely growing peace movement, attempt in the peace movement to avoid the payment of taxes. The Quakers, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the War Resisters League, a great many of them are trying to, the Catholic Worker Group in Chicago started it and renewed it, I think, and the War Resisters have taken it up until now they're getting out a special paper to give the news of what's happening to everybody who are using this technique.
Right.
Are there?
If you enlarge on the statement of the United People for the World Act, did you say that half the young fellows being called up in one state were refusing to respond?
Yes, those are the statistics.
Is that all over America or just one state?
That's the state of California.
State of California.
Yeah.
That's equivalent to our draft resistance here.
Well, there's many forms of draft resistance. Those who refuse to go but do show up when they're told to come to court, or they don't go out. They're not hiding out. They're making their protest by going on about their business and then going to jail.
Yes, but these chapters are.
Hmm?
These chapters you're referring to are.
No, they may be just avoiding the whole thing, trusting they'll be overlooked. Half of them don't answer to the call.
Thank you.
It seems to me that when you work, as you spoke this afternoon, requires a lot of faith. Perhaps you can tell us something about what kind of faith this has to be. Possibly relating this to your own experience. Must this be a faith in God which would sustain one in the courage either through his work or in your experience in America, is also done, can also be done without it. This is, I would link another question. This is a matter of patience and success. It seems to me that all the work you're doing, this has been done according to the basis of Tolstoy before, while it achieves great things, still that will achieve social order. Do you have faith in eventually will change the social order, or is this a question which does not definitely politically arise? I can't define what I want to say very clearly, but I feel that the question of peace, courage, and patience in this context are all bound up together in some way.
I don't get the whole question. You have to interpret it to me. I don't know. I mean, I don't only understand half of it.
Are you interested in changing the social order at all?
Yes, I'm absolutely interested in changing the social order. I think we need a new social order. I think our present capitalist industrialist system is inhuman and wicked. And I think that we need to think in terms of rebuilding a social order. The nonviolent are trying to rebuild it within the shell of the old, Peter Morin's phrase. And I pointed out two examples of that, and that was with the blacks in the South and the Mexicans and Filipinos in the West Coast. And they are doing it nonviolently through such means as organization and credit unions and cooperatives and mutual aid and boycott. And all the publicity. The growers have hired, at the expense of $1 million, the Madison Avenue advertising people to present their picture. And how have the poor done it? They've done it by their processions and by their suffering and by their picket lines and by their boycott.
The other part of the question, McCarthy, was do you believe in God in order to carry on this work, or could you be a humanist?
Well, I've always been terribly impressed by the humanists that I've met who have carried on in such with such a spirit. I'm thinking right now of a Russian writer, Solzhenitsyn, who's written a book called The First Circle and another one called The Cancer Ward. A man who is definitely not a religious man or a believer, but who has a tremendous sense of man's dignity and his responsibility and the absolute necessity for him to work for his brothers. I heard a story once from one of the bishops who said that he was quoting the Bible, quoting scripture, when he said he told a story that Jesus told about the father who had two sons. And one son said, "I will," and then went out and did not do as the father told him. And the other one said, "I won't," and yet he did go out. And from my view, for instance, of Cuba, I visited there in 1963, from my view of Cuba, there is there an attempt made to rebuild the social order. There is freedom of religion there, although all the Catholic schools have closed. I received communion, went to Mass every day that I was there. There are 500 catechetical groups and a retreat house. And in the cities, there are the churches open. In the countryside, there never were any churches anyway. And there you find, in this attempt to rebuild a social order, another social order, a communism what they call Marxism-Leninism, but which certainly is an order which is following the lines of trying to build another social order where man's needs will be supplied, not a big industrial state, but a state which is far more self-sustaining. Then you have in Tanzania a Catholic head of the state, Nyerere, Julius Nyerere, who's going ahead and nationalizing all the land, which is a move which has made him, of course, be hailed by socialists and communists as a man who is making a proper start in trying to remedy the conditions of the poor. But Nyerere is trying to go ahead and use the ideas of Israel in the kibbutzim and the moshavim and building up the use of land for the benefit of all. So that you see these examples. You see a religious example and you see a non-religious example. And I certainly in my life have had many, many friends who were not religious in the sense of belonging to an institutional church, but who have such a striving after good and such a desire to express their sense of their responsibility for their brothers, that I would say it's a very strong religious sense.
During the text that you and some of your followers went to Rome in order to try and get the bishop behind a statement putting the church behind movements for peace, for the condemnation of violence and of nuclear weapons and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if you could tell us something about that and something about your work. What they were on the vision to get a change in that something.
Your work for peace and the Second Vatican Council, when you went with Eileen to try and get the bishops to make a statement on peace.
I'd like to have Eileen answer that question because we went together there. And also, we worked very closely together in the peace movement in the States. And so she also has done far more than I have. The last exploit, which I consider a real exploit, was standing out in the rain and snow and sleet of a Washington winter while the bishops were in conference every single day in a vigil at noontime, to go ahead and impress upon their minds the necessity of their taking up this issue of selective conscientious objection. And also, the Pax group has the patience to go step by step by step and to take up every one of these issues. So she has been so active in it and has been to Rome with various other groups. The first time I went to Rome was with a group of women, all of whom went to thank Pope John for his encyclical Pacem in Terris. They represented every faith, even to some very obscure Protestant sects from the South. And it was a very interesting group of people trying to come and to greet the Holy Father. But they were very much frowned on because it was suspected there was a communist in their midst. I found out later that I was supposed to be the communist.
Can I lean the idea of the island
speaking? Another question first.
I'll just tell you a few brief things about what happened at Vatican II. At the next to the last session of the Second Vatican Council, an American bishop helped to inaugurate the discussion of peace and war by saying that the deterrent, the nuclear deterrent, was important to the defense of the free world. And two British bishops helped him by saying that you could use nuclear bombs morally, especially if you used them against ballistic missiles in the outer atmosphere. Now, we know that that isn't quite the idea in having a stockpile of nuclear weapons. The question of peace and war was to be discussed at the last session of the Second Vatican Council in 1965. We ascertained that, and we also were able to get, through means I can't describe, the various versions of the peace-war statement. When we read them, we felt we ought to be there to do what we could. So we went over, and Dorothy Day and 18 other women went on a 10-day fast, a total fast, except for liquids. Now, a fast...
Water, no other liquid, no coffee.
Yes, this is very important, because I was with Dorothy when she had her last lingering cup of coffee before that fast. It was only water. A fast can be of many types. It can be a coercive fast. I'll fast until you do something. But this was not that kind. It was a fast in the Christian sense, the acceptance of suffering on yourself for the good that will come to others. And the good was supposed to come to the bishops in the form of enlightenment by the Holy Spirit on the peace question. So during the time when I was not a faster, I was running around from bishop to bishop with a statement which contradicted what our American Catholic bishop, only one or two, had said in favor of a nuclear deterrent. We felt that the nuclear deterrent was a threat to humanity, and that the bishops gathered in Rome were the stewards of the human family in talking about indiscriminate warfare. So when the question came up, the statement on peace and war was much closer to what we had hoped. And there was indeed that famous condemnation, the one ban of Vatican II, the only one was the ban on indiscriminate warfare, which would destroy whole areas or populations, and this was condemned as a crime against God and man. And Dorothy Day and those 18 other women, I think, did bring down some fire from on high as a result of their fast and only drinking water.
Would you? This will have to be the last question, I'm afraid.
Just I want to know what were Mrs. Day's specific views on the war in Vietnam, and at the same time, what are the limits of peaceful demonstrations?
Your views on Vietnam, John?
Naturally, I mean, it follows.
I would say, if I've been against all war, this war is one of the most horrifying of all. I began writing about it back in 1954, at the time of the defeat of the French. Pointing out, I wrote an article called Théophane Ménard and Ho Chi Minh. Théophane Ménard was a young Frenchman who went over there as a missionary and who saw exactly the evil done by the missionary who followed the state, who thought in terms only of the power of conquest, the imperialist. And to bring out the fact that here Ho Chi Minh, in his working for the independence of his people, was the hero, and Théophane Ménard was the saint, that he was looking upon all these men as brothers, all of them. This is when there was no North or South Vietnam. It was all one country. It was all French Indochina. And we have consistently, from every moment, been opposing the war in Vietnam. And I would say that it is the greatest preoccupation of all the students who come to us and who participate in every demonstration and who are constantly being brought to trial. And I'd say that half of our editors have been in prison on account of their protests against war and against, right now, this particular war. I myself have been in jail 6 times for refusal to take shelter during air raid drills, and sometimes a short period of 24 hours, another one of 3 days, another one of 15 days, another one of 30 days. And it was certainly an experience which went very well with all the rest of our work. It was, again, visiting the prisoner, which is one of the works of mercy, as well as making our opposition to war.
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, before I declare this meeting shut, I'd ask you to put your hands together for Dorothy Day.